Sunstone presents Feminist Approaches to Mormon Culture, recorded live at the 1986 Sunstone Theological Symposium, held August 20th through the 23rd. We take you to the Salt Lake Sheraton and Towers, where the program is just now beginning.
And remind you that admission to this and all sessions is by pre-printed name tag only, and registration is available in the mezzanine lobby. This session is entitled Feminist Approaches to Mormon Culture. Now, when I mentioned this title to a friend of mine, he replied, "Oh, I didn't think there were any feminist approaches, only retreats." The phenomenon of the women's retreat and of publications like Exponent 2 indicates the growing concern among women in the church about the attitudes expressed towards and the roles assigned to them. I've attended several such retreats, have written and produced a play about Mormon women, and for several years was frequently called upon to represent the local church organization by speaking on women's issues at various events. Yet, until recently, I, like many Mormon women, was reluctant to call myself a feminist. For most mainstream Mormons and Americans, feminist is a big bad word that calls up notions of libbers, ERA, burning bras, wearing business suits and sending children to daycare, Sonia Johnson wanting the priesthood and chaining yourself to the gates of Temple Square. Now, while I and my fellow panel members still do not fit that profile, or at least not all of it, I now do consider myself a feminist. This panel grew out of a seminar at the University of Utah in feminist literary criticism, which some of us participated in last spring. In the seminar, we immersed ourselves in the writings of all different sorts of writers with all sorts of different methodologies for discussing literature by and about women, ranging from militant political feminists like Toral Moy and her sexual textual politics, to big-name literary theorists like Annette Kolodny and her controversial essay Dancing Through the Minefield, to French feminists Luce Irigaray and Helene Cissou, who attempt to create a new women's discourse they call writing the body. Since all of us on the panel, besides attempting to be literary scholars, are also Mormon women, we have here a Relief Society president, a Young Women's president, and a gospel doctrine teacher, and all of us are mothers with several children, we have been forced to come to terms with how all of this relates to us in terms of our own lives in this subculture. What we will be considering today are some of the ways in which gender affects or informs discourse, writing, speaking, or other forms of communication by, about, or to women in the Mormon Church. What we will be presenting are not researched and documented dissertations, but rather we will be suggesting some promising new approaches and strategies for looking at women's place in the church. The history of Mormon feminist studies has roughly paralleled that of feminist studies at large. Early feminist scholars in the late 60s and early 70s, with newly awakened consciousness, focused primarily on images of women in male-generated texts, and not surprisingly, what they found, to their outrage, was a great deal of sexism. In the later 70s, however, women writing about women in literature began to focus on women's writing, to reconstruct a women's literary history, and to fight for inclusion of works by women in the overwhelmingly male canon of great writers. This second phase of feminist history has been especially productive in Mormon women's studies and includes the important historical work of women like Linda Newell and Val Avery, Carol Cornwall Madsen, Maureen Ersenbach Beecher, and Jill Mulvey Durr, and many others. The third stage in feminist studies of literature, however, is one in which scholars have begun to look not only at the content of writing by and about women, but at the very forms used to convey that content. Feminist writers like Nancy K. Miller, for example, have suggested that even the traditional plot of a novel, the one with the rising action, a climax and a denouement, you've all seen the little diagram that goes like that, is modeled on the male sexual experience. Other contemporary feminist critics are applying principles borrowed from psychoanalysis, Marxism, structuralism, deconstruction, reader response, all the latest critical methods and fads, to women's writing and to all literature itself to discover what difference gender makes in the ways we write, think, and speak. We think that a number of these more contemporary feminist critical methods could be very enlightening applied to Mormon culture with its own unique and or favorite genres of discourse, its rituals, its talks and speeches, its meetings, publications, and conferences. We would like to demonstrate a few of the possibilities suggested by third-stage feminist criticism for application to Mormon culture. Lisa Orne Bickmore will begin by discussing textual strategies for writing the female. Lisa received her MA degree from BYU and is currently a PhD candidate in English literature at the University of Utah. She is also a writer and a poet, a Relief Society social relations teacher, and a mother of three. She was recently released as Young Women's President in her ward. Susan Staker will talk about stories within stories, the limits of plot in female narrative. Susan received her MA degree from the University of Utah and is also currently a PhD candidate there. Her emphasis is on the study of narrative fiction. Susan is a former managing editor of Sunstone. She has also been historical fellow with the Church Historical Department, where she co-authored the book Sisters and Little Saints. She is also the mother of three children. Sharon Lee Swenson, who will speak to us on the subject, Is There an Angel in the House? Losing One's Life, Finding Meaning, and Mothering in Mormon Culture. Sharon is the director of the Utah Humanities Resource Center. She received her MA at the University of Utah and is currently working on a PhD in critical theory. She has taught numerous film classes for continuing education in the University Honors Program, as well as being a noted local film critic who has published in a number of publications in the Valley. Sharon has two children and serves as Relief Society president. My name is Doris Williams Elliott, and I will be speaking on the subject of the Mormon Conference Talk as Patriarchal Discourse. I earned my BA degree at BYU and an MA at the University of Utah. Have also spent 7 years teaching English and journalism in public schools in Utah and New York, and I'm currently an instructor at the BYU Salt Lake Center and a part-time graduate student at the University of Utah. My play about Mormon women, A Queen and a Mother, was published in Exponent 2. I am also the mother of three children and serve as the gospel doctrine teacher in my ward. Following the remarks of the four panel members, the remaining time will be used for questions from the audience, so you can store those up until we're finished. Lisa.
Textual strategies for writing the female. Beverly Wilding Harrison, a feminist theologian, writes in the Union Seminary Quarterly Review that the full world historical project which feminism envisages, that every female child and each and every community and culture will be born to share a full horizon of human possibility, is the longest revolution. All of the new feminisms finally share this, or something like this, as historical projects. In the past year, I've been working with the young women in the church, specifically as the president of the young women in my ward. So in some new ways, for me, this historical project began to have some immediacy. Working as I was with 10 to 15, sometimes severely disturbed young women, ranging in ages from 12 to 17, whose lives were texts being written, the words of which texts had not yet become entirely legible to me or to them, to their mothers, or to the church, all of whom hoped to help participate in the editorial process. The lives of the young are, in fact, textual territory that adults of all kinds feel free to inscribe upon. And yet these same textual territories seem for a while to resist inscription. And then the text finally emerges in its full readability, and we can all see our hands, our adult hands upon that text, our graffiti all over the place. One of the duties that I attended to as Young Women's President last year was to attend the first ever church-wide satellite broadcast designed only for young women. It was a duty that became a pleasure to me as I sat there and watched it, because as a discourse event, an event that was before all things meant to create, to generate a new discourse of the female, especially of the young female in the church. As a discourse event, it was various and moving and also surprising. It arose out of a historical moment in which the church as an institution has been expressing its concern and consternation over and about women, about declining statistics in all areas, changes of lifestyle, perhaps the participation of LDS women in the larger feminist discourse of our time, the lack of spiritual grounding for women in the church, or the perceived lack of that grounding. This satellite broadcast answered these concerns in many ways. The heart of the program was a video presentation of seven young women values, values that were to serve as a spiritual ground for the young women for the rest of their lives, the values of faith, the divine nature of each young person, individual worth, knowledge, choice and accountability, good works and integrity. Each of these values was displayed on two large colored banners unrolled from opposite sides of the tabernacle balconies. In addition, there were three sermons delivered by Elder Russell M. Ballard, President Ardith G. Capp, and Elder Gordon B. Hinckley. There was music sung in the piercingly sweet voices of teenage young women, including an original new song written especially for this event to celebrate the seven values called I Walk by Faith by Janice Capp Perry. But perhaps the most startling part of this event was a rendition of, a very stirring rendition of Shall the Youth of Zion Falter, directed in her inimitable enthusiastic fashion by Janie Thompson, and accompanied by at least 100, and I'm only guessing, but at least 100 young women marching through the tabernacle carrying large colored flags and wearing white dresses. It was a spectacular procession, and it was designed to function as a procession, as a ceremonial event, and as a spectacle. It lasted for about 7 or 8 minutes and ended the broadcast without comment, except for a closing prayer delivered by a young woman. Each of these events within the larger event had its own strategies for writing a discourse of the female. At the end of the conclusion of such an event, and upon its contemplation, I asked myself exactly what constitutes a discourse of the female in the church. It's a question that serves as a subtext for this whole event, and indeed for many events within the last 10 years that concern LDS women. The institution of women's general meetings, for instance, the Nauvoo Monument to Women, changes in programs and in curriculum. Does a discourse of the female mean writing a new discourse that includes women, that defines women? Does it mean inscribing women into an already existing discourse? Just who is it that has the textual power to write any of these discourses? Is it possible for women to write themselves in the context of an existing and overwhelming, even monolithic, patriarchal discourse that often denigrates or demeans women, but more often ignores and thus effaces or erases them? And specifically for this event, which was a deliberate effort to write a discourse to define and then, after the definition, to celebrate the new young woman, can it succeed in being a discourse that both liberates the female and inscribes her in the bonds of the faith? Before I suggest any answers to such questions, as obvious as some of these answers might seem, I'd like to take a look at what was said and done at the meeting and then suggest some tentative conclusions. The three sermons illustrated some textual strategies for creating a discourse of the female. Elder Ballard's talk, entitled Daughters of Zion, Scriptural Insights for the Young Women of the Church, was an organization into three headings of every scriptural, this is his words, every scriptural reference pertaining to females. And the three headings were Maiden of Truth, Daughter of Zion, and Elect Lady. What I found most interesting about Elder Ballard's sermon, though, was his method. To read the sacred books and to find out what they explicitly said about women, and then imposing upon that base of explicit pronouncements the headings that would suggest the defining characteristics of young womanhood. At one point in his talk, he suggested that priesthood bearers in the church were legal administrators in our church, and I found that a suggestive notion. If the law, legality, is God's word, as scripture or as revelatory statements and pronouncements by prophets, then priesthood bearers become administrators, not just of the ordinance, but of the word in our culture. This is underscored, too, by the fact that within the video presentation, there was a scriptural reference that accompanied each of the seven young women values. And all the other talking was done by women, but the scriptural references were read by a male voice. God's word thus becomes patriarchal law, And Elder Ballard's approach to the sacred word is indeed one of administering the word, of distributing the word to women. I have to point out that in all three sermons, there are explicit statements about the wide opportunities now available to women, and particularly in this talk, Elder Ballard talks about the capacity that women have for blessing others as mothers or as legislators, as leaders in the schoolroom or in the laboratory of truth. So I'm not trying to talk about the content as being specifically anti-woman or in some sense misogynist. What I'm trying to do is look at the method that he used to talk about women. His strategy is a way of generating a discourse of the female, and it is a strategy of administering the law, the legal administrator distributing the patriarchal word. Elder Gordon B. Hinckley's talk was the concluding sermon just before the flags and the marching. His talk was more along the lines of homiletic wisdom, but as a strategy for generating discourse, his talk too had many interesting features. He told of the great hope that he held for the young women there gathered, for they were to be the mothers of our grandchildren, our assurance of generations to come. This seems explicitly an attempt to write the young women in a very specific way, the appropriation of the female body in the service of generation, the patriarchal purpose. But he also discussed the potential for acting, for agency of the young women, citing the life of Florence Nightingale as an example of someone given over to good work. He also addressed the question of parity between the sexes in an oblique way, saying that he didn't like the usual distinction made between Aaronic priesthood and girls of similar age, saying that he preferred to that the titles of Aaronic priesthood and young women, which to me is still a mysterious distinction. But the question itself of the relationship and the parity of the sexes in the church has come up over and over in the past year in talks at various events. But the one thing I found the most interesting was Elder Hinckley's willingness to appropriate the sacred patriarchal word and rewrite it. For instance, in reading Doctrine and Covenants, section 58, verse 27, which is, "Verily I say unto you, men should be engaged, anxiously engaged in a good cause," he rewrote it, which is a simple rewriting, but still the strategy is very interesting. "Young women should be anxiously engaged in a good cause." And this is a strategy that President Kapp used extensively in her talk, at least 10 times, citing scripture or pronouncements of modern prophets to address young women explicitly when the sources themselves are not addressed explicitly to women at all. Such appropriations of the patriarchal word are one of the ways to write women into a patriarchal discourse, perhaps the only way. President Kapp is a speaker of great enthusiasm and personal power, and her talk was filled with images of largeness and grandeur, such as a mighty wave of righteous young women, or images of strength and activity to stand up and lead out for truth and righteousness. Her discourse of the female is one of grandeur. It is also a discourse that inscribes women in large letters within the existing patriarchal discourse. The song that was written especially for this event also shows another strategy for generating a discourse of the female. This was a song that takes the voice of a young woman speaking as I, and celebrates and avows these values that had been proposed at this meeting. And the words went, "I walk by faith, a daughter of heavenly parents, divine am I, in nature by inheritance," and so on, speaking in the first person with the voice of a young woman. In some ways, this is very interesting. I mean, it's a young woman of her within her will, speaking these words and vowing a certain kind of agency. But it's also an inscription upon her life. It's appropriating this voice, and in some ways, it's a kind of interesting wish fulfillment. I think something that we have for our youth. It's, in Jacques Lacan's word, it's a desire for our youth that becomes a demand. It's not, "I walk by faith," but, "You will walk by faith, won't you, please. So that too is another a way of generating a discourse of the female by appropriating her voice and speaking for her. And the last and the most stirring and startling and moving, perhaps, part of the whole event was this march that I told you about earlier. Beverly Harrison, the same feminist theologian that I quoted earlier, talks about processions as being patriarchal institutions, a way of sort of acting out power. But she also says that they're powerful human institutions. They have the power to celebrate and the power to give people power. They give people a sense of community and power and celebration. They're powerful because they're an embodiment. You see the people moving. You see them using their bodies and moving. And it's an embodiment of a kind of activity and of a kind of agency. So here we see, if you can envision in your mind, these women, young women, moving through the tabernacle in their white dresses, carrying these large banners or flags. A very moving sight and a very suggestive and powerful sight. But here also we have these girls dressed in white dresses, which suggest them again as texts that haven't been written yet, texts that haven't been inscribed, waiting to be inscribed by some discourse, whether it will be their own or the discourse of their prevailing culture. The conclusions that I kind of want to draw are, well, as you can tell by the way I said that, are tentative, because for me they are painful and frightening. Perhaps for some of the more braver of you, they won't be so frightening. We have to ask ourselves, how are we to write a discourse of women within a theological discourse or in the context of a theological discourse that is fundamentally patriarchal? The way that it's being done now within the context of the church is to appropriate the word as law, the patriarchal word, to inscribe a woman's discourse within patriarchal language. But then we have to ask ourselves if that strategy can serve in any way to liberate women from a discourse that also rules them. If it is the word as law, it is also a constraint, and it's a special constraint for women. Finally, patriarchal discourse will always seek to write the text of women's lives, because it is the law. It is the word, and the word generates the world. Hélène Cizeux, in The Laugh of the Medusa, argues that patriarchal discourse can never be adequate to female discourse, to the female experience. She says, "I shall speak about women's writing, about what it will do. Woman must write herself, must write about women and bring women to writing, from which they have been driven away as violently as from their bodies. Woman must put herself into the text, as into the world and into history, by her own movement." Just what does it mean for a woman to write herself? Well, women also are part of the patriarchal discourse, and so writing ourselves can be a confusing and contradictory experience. One of the things that happens when women write themselves is we write stories and texts that contain anger, that contain what seems to be faithlessness. Because as Jane Gallup points out, that faithlessness is a feminist practice. It's a way of undermining the name or the law of the Father. The unfaithful reading, the unfaithful reading strays from the author, and the authorized produces that which does not hold as a reproduction. And then again, Cizeux suggests that a feminine text cannot fail to be more than subversive. That's why it's so painful to suggest women writing themselves and writing their own discourse within the context of a discourse of faith, because sometimes it involves breaking the faith and writing outside of the faith. It means writing first out of difference, writing of the female experience as difference. But finally, if we have some kind of love or involvement in the faith, it also means writing ourselves into that discourse of faith, writing ourselves and our bodies back into the body of saints. A theology that talks about liberation has to first of all have as its aim that there will be no more excluded ones, no one excluded from the discourse. And so in order to generate a discourse that can include and celebrate a true discourse of the female, women have to start writing and speaking for themselves.
Stories within stories, the limits of plot in female narrative. People live inside stories, as it were, writes Jan Shipps in her recent book, Mormonism, The Story of a New Religious Tradition. In other words, there is a direct connection between the story of the world, that is, creation and its past history, and everyday experience. She goes on to explore at length the particular story we Mormons have told about our own history and the world, and how we live inside that story. Today I will talk a little less globally about the stories we tell about ourselves, but I hope you will keep in mind what Jan is saying, that one of the ways we explain the world is by telling stories about it, and that different ways of telling the same story, in fact, create different worlds to live in. At the very least, this way of talking about narrative helps us to take stories more seriously, and also helps us to look for plots and stories in places we might otherwise miss. We are used to thinking about made-up stories, tragedies. We're used to looking for different kinds of made-up stories. We have tragedies, comedies, romances, satires. But these stories are fictions. Real-life stories are different. They are stories that really happened. Real-life stories are not made. We like to think that they are in some sense found. As historians, for example, we are never writing stories. We are simply trying to tell what really happened. On the contrary, I would like to suggest that real-life stories are also, in a fundamental stories that sense, stories that we make up. Hayden White, in such books as Metahistory and Tropics of Discourse, has discussed at length how the same contents, events, characters, the stuff of history, can be implotted in any number of different ways. White would therefore argue that in looking at the kinds of explanations that are made in history, we should look beyond the overt arguments about the causes of events, okay, where the person who's writing it is saying, this happened because, and they should look at the kind of story that's told. In other words, the kind of story, how the story is told, will tell you as much as what's in the story. This digression on stories really is relevant to what I want to say today about gender and narrative. I want you to understand why I talk about real-life stories and made-up stories as if they were somehow the same kind of thing. I think in a real important sense they are. I also want you to understand why I think that the literary critic has any legitimate business invading that domain which has been so often ceded to the historian. For the past year, I've been reading and writing about endings in fiction. And more recently, I've been writing about endings in women's fiction. What I have are merely suggestive hypotheses about how gender might make the difference in the shape of stories and how endings specifically might be interesting in women's stories. Today I'm going to suggest that we consider how these intuitions might apply to stories by Mormon women, whether these stories are fictional or historical. What has become the conventional notion about the importance of endings was articulated by two literary critics writing in the 1960s, Barbara Herrnstein Smith in her book Poetic Closure and Frank Kermode in a book called The Sense of an Ending. Both critics emphasize that the ending of a story often provides the key to interpretation. The ending is stable. Most of the loose ends of the story get tied off there. According to Smith, that stability gives you a place from which you can sort of look back over the story and see what it really was about. So in a way, it sort of gives you a key to how to pattern what was going on in the story. And from that ending, the reader can often see things that they didn't see the first time through, or they can see things that at first seemed gratuitous. You know, you've all had the experience of reading a book once and then reading it the second time, and you know how much different it is the second time through because you know how it's going to turn out, and so you know how to read it. According to Cormeaux, the same sort of thing is true. Stories rescue events from what he calls simple chronicity, or humanly uninteresting successiveness. Endings do this, and they charge these events with significance. Cormeaux is especially interesting because his whole book is centered around what he calls the archetypical story of the ending, which is the apocalypse. And he talks about how our looking forward to the ending and the particular way in which the world is going to end, in a sense, gives meaning to everything that happens in human history. We know which things are important because we know how it's going to end. Now, I'm going to turn to one particular ending written by a great woman writer, and I would like to suggest that the issues that she raises help to make clear why I think this model of the ending simply doesn't work for a lot of stories, and it particularly doesn't work for a lot of stories that are written by women. I am quoting from the afterword to George Eliot's great 19th century novel, Middlemarch. George Eliot was the pen name for a woman named Marianne Evans. The central character in this novel is Dorothea Brooke, an intelligent and ambitious woman who first marries, unhappily, the pedantic and sterile cleric Casaubon, and after his death struggles towards love and freedom in a marriage to Casaubon's nephew, Will Ladislaw. In the afterword, Eliot turns to the subject of how stories about a female life can be plotted, specifically how you could tell a story about Dorothea. In doing so, she addresses the larger question of what endings are possible in a story about women. Quote, "Every limit is a beginning as well as an ending. Marriage, which has been the born of so many narratives, is still a great beginning, as it was to Adam and Eve, who kept their honeymoon in Eden, but had their first little one among the thorns and thistles of the wilderness." Notice the word which Eliot chooses as she begins to talk about the shape of story. Her choices are strategically important. Her crucial category is not beginnings and endings, really, but rather limit. Limit certainly suggests the destination or goal that Smith or Cormeaux would talk about. It's where it ends. But limit also suggests the possibility of ending as limitation. The second possibility imports a somewhat troubling note. The boundaries of a woman's story might also suggest the limitations of a woman's life. The word born that she chooses masterfully consolidates this meaning, because if you look up born in the dictionary, it can either mean limit or it can mean destination. It has both of those meanings. In the context set up by Eliot's choice of vocabulary, then, marriage, the event she singles out, might be thought of the goal or destination of a woman's life, but it also might be thought of as a limitation. Eliot exploits this context as she goes on to talk about Dorothea Brooke's marriage to Will Ladislaw, which ends the novel. He, quote, "the ardent public man, and she the wifely help." Many who knew her thought it a pity that so substantive and rare a creature should have been absorbed into the life of the other and be only known in a certain circle as a wife and mother. But no one stated exactly what else was that in her power that she ought rather to have done. Not even Sir James Chatham, who went no further than the negative prescription that she ought not to have married Will Ladislaw. Eliot returns to this issue of what she ought rather to have done in the final paragraphs of the book. Certainly these determining acts of her life were not ideally beautiful. They were the result of a young and noble impulse struggling against the conditions of an imperfect social state in which great feelings will often take the aspect of error and great faith the aspect of illusion. For there is no creature whose inward being is so strong that it is not greatly determined by what lies outside it. Her finely touched spirit still had its fine issues, though they were not widely visible. Her full nature, like that river of which Cyrus broke the strength, spent itself in channels which had no great name on the earth. But the effect of her being on those around her was incalculably diffusive, for the growing good of the world is partly dependent on historic acts. And that things are not so ill with you and me as they might have been is half owing to the number who live faithfully a hidden life and rest in unvisited tombs. In these passages, I think Eliot begins to unpack what was in that first sentence about beginnings and endings being limits. I'm particularly interested in what she's implying about female narrative, that authentic feelings and energies may be disguised in the aspect of error or illusion. They may be diffused through the text as this river that's spent in many channels, or they may be buried, entombed, hidden. They're going to be someplace where you don't see them. Clearly, these suggestions challenge the notion of theorists such as Smith and Kermode that an ending can pattern the meaning of a woman's life. Rather, an ending may simply reflect the constraints or limits of what can happen to a woman in a story or what can happen to a woman in life. The more personal meaning of a woman's life may have to be recovered in those moments that are diffused or hidden or that may look like error or illusion. I keep returning to Eliot's statement about those who would criticize Dorothea, but no one stated exactly what else that was in her power she ought rather to have done. How do you tell a story when there is for the most part only one way to tell that story, one possible ending, when the plots and plausibilities for a woman's narrative are largely fixed by social and ideological constraints? This is the same question addressed by Nancy K. Miller in a very influential essay in feminist criticism entitled Emphasis Added, Plots and Plausibilities in Women's Fiction. Miller suggests that women find ways of adding their own emphasis to a received story, of creating, in effect, quote, what she calls an italicized version of what passes for the neutral or standard face. Spoken or written, italics are a modality of intensity and stress, a way of marking what has already been said, of making a common text one's own. So in other words, you can tell the same story, but you can sort of emphasize things in a different way. In the background of Miller's discussion is the French feminist Luce Irigaray, who has also written about how the authentic energies of a woman's life can find play within stories and ideas, quote, elaborated in and through a masculine logic. Irigaray's imperative is, quote, to the recovery of a possible operation of the feminine in language. It is also to unveil the fact that if women mime so well, they are not simply reabsorbed in this function. They also remain elsewhere. I like that phrase. However intriguing the notion that women may find ways of simultaneously telling and not telling or retelling an old story, these are very abstract ideas. How do we recognize this italicized version of the story, or how do we figure out where women are elsewhere? In her essay, Miller suggests one possibility, which will shortly bring me back to endings in Mormon stories. According to Miller, women writers often cede to characters within the narrative what is more conventionally given over to a narrator. She is especially interested in how the text might deal or not deal with breaches in narrative or social decorum, anything where what the people does seems a little strange or outlandish, or where the story itself may do something weird. Now, she would argue that a Balzac would most likely acknowledge that something weird has happened and that the narrative voice would somehow explain what's going on. She would argue that a Charlotte Bronte would be more likely to, if she talked about the strangeness at all, let a character do it, and perhaps even a character that is not explicitly approved of by the narrator. Now, Miller is not claiming that men always do this, or that they must do this in their stories, and that women always do this, or that they must do this. Rather, she is suggesting that women often do cede a lot of influence to their characters, but more importantly, she's suggesting that it's because of issues of gender that they do this. Women often have very good reasons to disguise or at least diffuse potentially dangerous narrative energies. They might quite understandably allow their characters to assume responsibility for highly charged moments. Usually readers do not distinguish between a narrator and an author in assigning responsibility. So if the narrator says it, someone's most likely to say, oh, Jane Austen said that, or George Eliot said that. But if the character says it, you say, oh, Dorothea said that, or Jane Fairfax said that. I'm particularly interested in Miller's claim because it coincides with my own intuitions and hypotheses about endings in women's fiction, especially in the 19th century, though in some ways, in some places, I would be willing to argue things haven't changed much in the 20th. One thing that a woman often does when she tells her own italicized version of a received story is to throw the weight off the ending of the story. In other words, she refuses this ending that gives a meaning to everything else. And what she does is give you some clues along the way that you can take this ending and, that you don't need to quite put the weight there. And usually what happens when that weight is refused in the ending is that the force of the story goes back to that polyphony of voices competing for energy and tensions that's the middle of the story. With a number of reservations, I've decided to use a personal experience for my Mormon example. Partly I have the nerve to do this because I don't believe that a narrative must be great literature in order to be interesting as narrative. In fact, I would very much like to set aside the issue of value, the old question, is it good, is it artistic, in this discussion. Rather, the question I want to ask is, how does a narrative work? And why might this be so? Back in the days of Leonard Arrington's History Division Camelot, I was assigned the task with Carol Cornwall Madsen of writing a story of the LDS primary, a book that was eventually published through Desert Book as Sisters and Little Saints. It's been 8 years since I worked on the book, and a lot has happened, which gives me a certain feeling of distance on that project. But I can still talk to you about authorial intention, which isn't so easy with most other texts. I haven't talked to Eliza R. Snow or Jane Austen. So that gives me, I can say this is what I was thinking. And you will now see why I set up my elaborate introduction about history and so-called fiction lie on a continuum, and why literary types have any business messing around in the stuff of history. As Hayden White suggests, implotting the story was an important part of writing that history. Now, this story had to make it through Boyd K. Packer, the General Primary Presidency, the editors at Deseret Book, and several anonymous readers, primary sisters who lived out in the valley somewhere. As you can see, this was a book whose plot had been written, whose happy ending was firmly fixed long before we began writing, and even before we opened a single minute book or perused one letter in the archives. This would be a story of progress, of cumulative achievement, each step a step forwards. I personally had reservations, even a sense of sadness about that ending towards which we were mandated to write, an ending which had to include the primary women losing control over their hospital, over their money, over their magazine, over their curriculum. I had researched and was writing about the first 50 years of the organization when all of those projects, as well as many others, had been initiated by women who felt excited and inspired. I find it interesting from a vantage of these 8 years to try to describe the structure of the narrative that we wrote. Just looking at the chapter titles gives you a clue. 6 of the 10 titles are quotations from women's diaries and letters and minutes. Could there not be an organization worthy of all honor, going up against the stone wall? As I look back over the book, I was struck at how often individual voices are ceded to the women, how often the narrative voice cedes the authority to the women. Because of education, social welfare work, building a hospital, printing magazines, and raising money, planning curriculum. A paragraph from the preface of the book can illustrate what I see happening both locally and globally over and over again in the book. Here's the paragraph. And notice, first of all, the topic sentence of the paragraph and then what the paragraph's about. Another major concern of women was the health and physical well-being of their children. In August 1873, at the suggestion of Brigham Young, Eliza R. Snow issued a call to women to study medicine either at home or away in order to become midwives, nurses, and even doctors. Several women left home and family for 3 or 4 years in order to receive medical degrees from accredited Eastern colleges, returning home to put their training to work in behalf of other people. Ellis Reynolds Shipp, one of the faithful women who answered the call to study medicine, traveled all the way to Philadelphia to attend a women's medical college. Quote, "This separation is oh, so trying to my mother heart," she noted in her diary, "but I am willing to suffer myself if I can thereby increase and improve the advantages of my dear children." When Dr. Shipp returned to Salt Lake City, she taught medicine to hundreds of women throughout the territory who utilized their training to assist women in childbirth and children in sickness. That's the end of the quote. Ostensibly, this material is included because it shows how interested the women were in helping the children. But of course, this example is also the story of 19th century married Mormon women studying medicine in the East and leaving children at home to do it. Only this event is not one of those moments given a particular weight by the ending of the narrative. And notice how this moment is spun out. Here we have the cast of characters, Brigham, Eliza, the anguished voice of Ellis Shipp, in effect assuming responsibilities for this moment. I've chosen to talk about history today. I think we could take the same questions and concerns to biographies and autobiographies and to the fictions we write as well. But I can't help but wonder if the increased interest in women's history, which we have seen in the past decade in circles such as this one today, is not a significant phenomenon related to the issues I've been discussing. I wonder if we don't find it easier to tell our own stories. So what I'm suggesting, in a sense, is oftentimes the story that we tell when we're writing history is as much the story of what's happening today as it is the story of what was happening in the time the history was written. I wonder if we don't find it easier to tell our own stories by displacing them into the voices of our 19th century sisters and by diffusing them through stories already much told. It is as if the much told story is a potential disguise for other stories more risky to tell. Perhaps we can take a new set of questions and strategies to these much told stories and make them yield their secrets. At the very least, we should be more sensitive to signs that a, quote, italicized version of the neutral or standard face might be possible, signs that the conventional limits of the narrative may be as much limitation as destination, that the weight of the comfortable ending has been refused, that unsettling voices may echo still. We may begin to see how women have responded to the limits or bourne of narrative and life, how they have created strategic spaces within the old stories for different stories. Perhaps this is how women have responded to Eliot's, "No one stated exactly what else that was in her power she ought rather to have done."
Is there an angel in the house? Losing one's life, finding meaning, and mothering in Mormon culture. For feminists, gender is important. Sex may be important too, but that's irrelevant to our very academic discussion today. Now, is gender biological or social? As a Mormon, I would add, is it spiritual? When is gender decided, and by whom? Did we pick? Did God pick? Who decided? For Mormons, nice is important, maybe even more important than good. But certainly niceness is a token of goodness. And motherhood is the ultimate niceness. Mothering, both being a mother and having one, is an issue fraught with controversy, both among feminists and among Mormons. And let me state at the outset that both of these worlds are complex, ambivalent, and constantly shifting. I want to freeze frame them very briefly and discuss some major issues with a personal eye. And I want to describe these worlds as I see them. And I have to let you know, too, that when I looked in the mirror, I thought, oh, a Mormon mother. Oh, look at Mormon mothering. I said I'd look and find myself. I saw instead a Medusa head that terrified me so much. I find it hard to speak about this. My own unresolved issues with my mother, my unresolved issues as a mother, and now as Relief Society as mother of my ward, has snared my feet, though it has not stopped my tongue. So I will continue, given those handicaps. Realizing that every generalization is untrue because it is a generalization, let me lay out some basic terms. My subtitle suggests generalizations from the two axes I'm going to be looking at. Basically, Mormons believe that good mothers lose their lives and find meaning by giving life to others, to their children, their spouses, their parents, and miscellaneous ward members and friends that need help, or that don't need help, but you're compelled to give to them. Feminists have been perceived as believing that individual women can find meaning and acquire identity by creating their own space, by separating themselves from bonds with families and institutions which limit or stereotype. Now, what I'm doing today is strongly influenced by the French feminists, and you've heard a little bit of quote from Hélène Sissou and Lucie Ercoret. French feminists deny a linear left-brain organization. They believe in multi-flowing and moving. So I'm going to flow and move, but for those of you who don't like to flow and move, I'm telling you sort of where we're going. This is sort of a map for listening. I'm going to talk, first of all, about kind of general context. I'm going to talk about Mormon context. Then I'm going to talk about feminist on mothering context. Then I'm going to zoom in to one little feminist and talk about her discussion of a point that's relevant to both, and then pull back out and talk about me. So that's where we're going. Fasten your seatbelts. We're off. Let me isolate, first of all, a cultural object, realizing no brief description can do justice to the multifaceted reality. The object under consideration is an archetypal Mother's Day sacrament meeting. The speakers, male and female, will praise mothers for their unstinting sacrifice, for always being home to greet us with milk and cookies and home-baked bread with hand-ground wheat and honey, which she got from the hive just moments before we arrived. Someone will be grateful for the influence of her mother on her life. If the speaker's male, often he will link his mother and his wife, expressing gratitude for the influence both have had on his life. Underlying the talk to the assumption that women are inherently more spiritual, instinctively more nurturing than men. Someone may say, the hand that rocks the cradle rules the world. I heard this last Mother's Day, I promise you, in my ward. Or following the Abe Lincoln tradition, all that I am or ever hope to be, I owe to my angel mother. Someone will articulate appreciation and wonder at the sacrifices made by his or her mother. Songs will include cherub voices chirping, Mother dear, I love you so, your happy smiling face. You're such a joy to look at, you make home a lovely place. I can't chirp. All music numbers will be lyrical and sweet. When my mother calls me, swiftly I obey, and I love to, I don't know this one, you go walking through the fields of flowers. I didn't learn this one as a primary child, haven't quite added to the repertoire. No music will have this martial, assertive kind of thing. We're so glad when daddy comes home. None of that. This is Mother's Day. All right, this is the Mormon context. Now, the relevant feminist material is complex and paradoxical and totally without songs that I can sing to you here. Particularly relevant to the discussion are five works, which you should all read. Jean Baker Miller, Toward a New Psychology of Women. Adrienne Rich, Of Woman Born, Motherhood as Experience and Institution. Nancy Chodorov, The Reproduction of Mothering, Psychoanalysis and the Sociology of Gender. Dorothy Dinnerston, The Mermaid and the Minotaur, Sexual Arrangements and Human Malaise. And Carol Gilligan, In a Different Voice. The brief summary I can make of these relevant aspects are, one, separation is tough, both for mother and child. The discovery about two or three that I am not my mother, I am like, unlike her in vital ways. Males discover I have a penis and my mother doesn't. This shock of separation then leads to a recognition of difference, which is crucial. The discovery of the difference leads men to conclude that they must seek autonomy. They must deny and fear women's power. There's a very complicated argument here that has to do with castration fears and the lack and the other and the having and the not having. Women, instead, have a compulsive or instinctive need for connectiveness, extending the sense of likeness with the mother and the pleasure of being with her to valuing and emphasizing relationships and connectedness. The source of women's power and their weakness is their otherness. They are not men. Language is phallologocentric. This means language was created by men to serve men's need to maintain object-subject relationships. This is the object, I am the subject. I am it, it is the other. I have a penis, it doesn't. Those kinds of distinctions. And they maintain this particularly with people. The word limits and denies reality, feminists say, because it says we only know what we can say. We don't actually speak the mother tongue. Feminists say, no, we dance it. Women cannot write ourselves with male language. We must ride it with our bodies. Male language, both words and patterns of writing, reflect male sexuality beginning, middle, and climax, reaching the narrative climax. Women's language is different, circular, multi-sided, and expressive of a full range of emotions and experience that are not linked to the verbal, not to the subject-object. Men and women are different. There's agreement on that across the line, except for some very political feminists who want to deny that. Should we celebrate or deny our differences? And lastly, the notion of binary opposition. When you say one thing, you have not said the other. If there are opposites, one is always privileged or valued, and the other is not. Okay, now we're coming back. Mormon motherhood is an extreme form of Mormon niceness. It's an idealization that makes clear general tendencies we see elsewhere in the culture. In Professions for Women, Virginia Woolf tells of her first experience writing. Now, I want you to know, Virginia Woolf was not a mother. Like so many notable women writers, she didn't have children, which is probably why she was a notable writer. Her account of this beginning experience exemplifies one of the problems, and again, I'm focusing down on this small, small part of mothering and feminism. She sat down to write a review of a novel by a famous man. She discovered she could write reviews and send it off, and then people would send her money, and then she could buy Persian cats. And it was a wonderful arrangement. She wanted to continue. So she sat down to write this review of a novel by a famous man, but she was very inhibited. These are her words. "I discovered that if I were going to review books, I should need to do battle with a certain phantom. And the phantom was a woman. And when I came to know her better, I called her after the heroine of a famous poem, The Angel in the House. It was she who used to come between me and my paper when I was writing reviews. It was she who bothered me and wasted my time, and so tormented me that at last I killed her. You who come of a younger and happier generation may not have heard of her. And may I add, you may not have heard of her, but you have met her, I know. You may not know what I mean by the angel in the house. I will describe her as shortly as I can. She was intensely sympathetic. She was immensely charming. She was utterly unselfish. She excelled in the difficult arts of family life. She sacrificed herself daily. If there was chicken, she took the leg. If there was a draft, she sat in it. In short, she was so constituted that she never had a mind or a wish of her own, but preferred always to sympathize with the minds and wishes of others. Above all, I need not say it, she was pure. Her purity was supposed to be her chief beauty, her blushes, her great grace. In those days, the last of Queen Victoria, every house had its angel, and when I came to write, I encountered her with the very first word. Shadow of her wings fell on my page. I heard the rustling of her skirts in the room. Directly, that is to say, I took my pen in hand to review that novel by a famous man. She slipped behind me and whispered, my dear, you're a young woman. You are writing about a book that's been written by a man. Be sympathetic. Be tender. Flatter. Deceive. Use all the arts and wiles of our sex. Never let anybody guess you have a mind of your own. Above all, be pure." And she made as if to guide my pen. I now record the one act for which I take some credit to myself, though the credit rightly belongs to some excellent ancestors of mine who left me a certain sum of money, shall we say £500 a year, so that it was not necessary for me to depend solely on charm for my living. I turned upon her and caught her by the throat. I did my best to kill her. My excuse, if I were to be had up in a court of law, would be that I acted in self-defense. Had I not killed her, she would have killed me. She would have plucked the heart out of my writing. For, as I found, directly I put pen to paper, you cannot review even a novel without having a mind of your own, without expressing what you think to be the truth about human relations, morality, sex. And all these questions, according to the angel of the house, cannot be dealt with freely and openly by women. They must charm, they must conciliate, they must, to put it bluntly, tell lies if they are to succeed. Thus, whenever I felt the shadow of her wings or the radiance of her halo upon my page, I took up the inkpot and flung it at her. She died hard. Her fictitious nature was of great assistance to her. It is far harder to kill a phantom than a reality. She was always creeping back when I thought I had dispatched her. Though I flatter myself that I killed her in the end, the struggle was severe. It took much time that had better have been spent upon learning Greek grammar or in roaming the world in search of adventures. But it was a real experience. It was an experience that was found to befall all women writers at that time. Killing the angel in the house was part of the occupation of a woman writer. I would add, it is also part of the occupation of being a woman, and particularly of being a mother. I think that her essay offers us not only a description of a certain phenomenon, which is not exclusively female, let me hasten to add, there are a lot of male angels flitting in our houses, but is somehow, she suggests a solution too. I chose her words to describe this because I found I could not speak of my experience, that I am mired at this point in that dilemma and the choices and the implications of mothering and of being mothered, and we're not able to speak. But I can tell you about some limitations of this angel in the house. This woman does not choose good. She has no choice. There's no volition. She has no agency. And I want to add that for every angel in the house, there is a mad woman in the attic, raging, but not access to the rest of the house. Now, The Mad Woman in the Attic is the title of a very important book, a study of writers in the 19th century, which says that because women were not able to express tiv of the novel, they created characters. Most of you are familiar with Jane Eyre, probably. The Mad Woman in the Attic, the first wife, the woman who goes mad, who cannot speak, and who must be killed before life can go on. So we've got a tension here between the Mad Woman in the Attic and the Angel Ones. And I think if you look at it in binary terms, you have some pretty unpleasant choices. Are you going to let the Mad Woman go and let her run your life? Or are you going to kill the angel? You're going to let the angel go and run your life. Feminist theory makes it clear this is not the only choice that you have. We're not dealing here simply with binary opposition. We are not simply saying you have to be one or the other. We can choose to get the angel and the madwoman to dance together, to get them together in our house and to dance, to waltz through, to dance over the minefields of language and of living that we have. And I don't have time to go any further, but I want to just briefly suggest some areas we can look to, considering that the feminist theory on mothers. First of all would be the nature existence and the sacred secret nature of our Heavenly Mother, and what implications feminist theory about mothering has to do with her existence. What is the implications for our choice of being connected? Do we as women have no choice but to be connected? Do our sons have no choice but to connect from us? The nature of power, influence, and choices. If in fact there are angels dancing in the ward houses as well as in our homes, can we make any solution about how they dance, where they dance, what they do, without destroying the church as it currently exists in terms of service? The questions about sisterhood, about being connected to other women and being connected to our mothers as well as to our children and our spouses. Can we find a gender-free name for fellowshipping? The best I could come up with was person boating, which I don't think is going to catch on as a verb and activity of the official structure of the church. It also has implications for the nature of nurturance. What is the difference between motherhood and fatherhood? Do men and women, in fact, nurture differently? And is there any way that we can benefit from that difference, or do we simply have to live with it? I think that my own experience in working with this material is that I recognize not just a world of thought that was important, but myself. I spoke of looking in the mirror and seeing the Medusa head. I'd seen the angel much earlier, and while not killing her, had decided to dispatch her promptly to a room of her own where she could come out only on appropriate occasions, like canning pears for welfare and making salads for funerals. She did not go easy and appears constantly. In fact, today she hovered over me saying, "Please don't do this. You'll be so sorry if you go ahead." But I wanted to close by telling you that, yes, there may be an angel in the house, but you can find her without losing your life. discover the meaning, and we're our own best mothers. Thank you.
We had quite an argument in our panel about who had to go after Sharon, and since I was the moderator, it fell to me rather than being chosen. As I began thinking about the subject of Mormon discourse for this panel, I jotted down a list of Mormon genres. The first two that came to my mind, and the two which I believe are the most powerful, the most authoritative in Mormon culture, were the temple endowment and the conference talk. The temple ceremony because of its secrecy, and the conference talk because of its public nature. Because I am still a practicing Mormon, I've decided not to do a feminist analysis of the form of the temple endowment, although that would be an interesting project. I have to admit to have done it in my mind, but I will not share those insights with you, unless you want to meet me in the celestial room at some point. Instead, I will focus my attention on a conference talk. What I want to look at is not so much the content of the talk, but at the form, which has developed into something fairly unique to our culture, and at how it relates to and expresses gender. In other words, I will be looking at the message of the medium, specifically the gendered message. The talk I will be analyzing is one by President Gordon B. Hinckley from the General Women's Meeting last September, which was reprinted in the November Ensign along with the talks from General Conference. Now, I chose this talk for a couple of reasons. It's an interesting case because the content is quite progressive, but it is undermined by the powerful message of the form. Also, it is an instance of an inherently patriarchal discourse, but it's directed specifically at a female audience. And that's so I will touch on some of the issues that Lisa has already raised, but in maybe more specific terms. I want especially to note here that it is not my intent to criticize President Hinckley. This is a good talk by a good man, even a progressive talk, significant because it gives institutional weight to women's concerns. President Hinckley, like all of us, speaks in the discourse available to him. We are all trapped by the language in which we speak and think. President Hinckley's talk, entitled 10 Gifts from the Lord, is addressed explicitly to women who wonder why they don't have the priesthood, and is an effort to demonstrate what privileges women have which compensate for lack of priesthood power. As such, it directly, though tactfully, engages issues of power, institutional as well as spiritual power. Now, power is another one of what I call the big bad words, and many of us are uncomfortable about admitting that we want power, and for women to want power is downright unfeminine. But there are many ways to define power, and some of our most sacred ceremonies are designed to enable us to share God's power, even women. So please keep that in mind when I use that word throughout this talk. Paradoxically, the form of President Hinckley's talk, while addressing issues of women's power, power to serve, to teach, lead, pray, and prophesy, powerfully asserts his own greater power, and by extension, that of all males in the church. Now, since you don't have the talk in front of you, I'm not going to go over it in detail, but I want to discuss a few ways in which this power is asserted through the discourse, and especially the most interesting moment in the talk, the text navel, as one writer puts it, where that power is threatened. Now, although I will be speaking about President Hinckley's talk primarily as a talk, an oral presentation, let me first say a word about its presentation in written form in the Ensign. Although President Hinckley's talk was actually delivered last in the actual meeting, which is the position of most impact, or the power position, in print it occurs first, which is the most powerful position in that setting. The description of the meeting, introduction to the General Women's Meeting, explains that Latter-day Saint women and girls 10 years and older joined with those in the tabernacle on Temple Square to receive counsel from President Gordon B. Hinckley, second counselor in the First Presidency, Elder J. Thomas Fiennes of the Presidency of the First Quorum of 70, Sister Barbara W. Winder, Relief Society General President, Sister Ardith G. Capp, Young Women General President, and Sister Dwan J. Young, Primary General President. This introduction implies that the women assembled primarily to hear the men speakers, and secondarily, the women. As with all the talks printed in the conference issue, a photo of the speakers appears in the first column. President Hinckley looks serious, dignified, and intent, as do all the other male speakers in the entire magazine except the one. The women's pictures, by contrast, show them smiling broadly, and in one case, actually pulling a face. Now, while the women's pictures are admittedly more engaging, they do not convey the same sense of authority. The kickers, the one-sentence excerpts from the talks, which are printed in italics below the titles, also tend subtly to give a sense of authority to the male speakers, especially President Hinckley, although I haven't time to go into that in detail here, but you look at them, you may see what I mean. The tone of authority in Hinckley's talk is established in his first three words, "I am confident," as compared to the women who begin, "Thank you, girls, how I wish, and my dear sisters." President Hinckley's syntax throughout is characterized by his almost exclusive use of imperative and strong declarative statements. "May your prayers be answered. I urge you. Spare yourselves the indulgence of self-pity. Do not worry away your lives with concerns over rights. Accept the challenge. Go forward," etc. When President Hinckley expresses a wish, as did Sister Cap, he says not, "How I wish," but more directly, "I wish he were." President Hinckley begins his talk by establishing, humbly, his position as spokesman for the First Presidency by explaining the absence and relaying the blessings of Presidents Kimball and Romney. He follows this by invoking the central binary opposition that is the foundation of both his talk and of the church attitude toward women in general. "We, the brethren leaders, and you, the women." Says President Hinckley, "In behalf of these, our brethren and leaders, in behalf of the First Presidency of the Church, I thank you, all of you, wherever you may be, you great Latter-day Saint women." The notion of binary oppositions, which has already been touched on, is central to the thought processes of Western civilization, as it is to Mormon culture. There must needs be an opposition in all things. Even our ability to perceive objects depends on our perception of their differences from other objects. But contemporary deconstructionist critics point out that wherever there is a binary opposition, truth, error, presence, absence, identity, difference, speech, writing, being, nothingness, life, death, mind, matter, master, slave, one half of the pair is privileged. There is always, says Jacques Derrida, a violent hierarchy in which one of the terms governs the other or has the upper hand. We can be quite comfortable with such violent hierarchies when the concepts involved are good and evil, life and death, sin and righteousness, love and hatred, joy and pain. But when the pair is man-woman, the dichotomy is less comfortable. Here we want to try to impose some notion of separate but equal, a notion which the Supreme Court and our own cultural system of logic says is not possible. Deconstructionists want us to learn to use and erase our language at the same time, and feminists want us to preserve positive difference while establishing full equality. But our language, as we use it currently, and as President Hinckley's talk uses it, does set up binary oppositions in which one half is clearly privileged. President Hinckley uses "you," "your," and "yours" so frequently and insistently throughout his talk that it becomes a refrain reminding women that they are the other. Even when he talks about himself growing up, he says, "When I was a boy growing up." He repeatedly uses phrases like, "the men as well as the women, their views, the women's, carry as much weight as do the views of any of the brethren, in the case of the women as it is in the case of the men. As surely as there is a temple president, there is also a temple matron," etc. Such phrases keep the terms constantly opposed, constantly locked in the hierarchy, even while asserting privileges and rights for women. This is even more apparent when, in his conclusion, President Hinckley begins using the rhetorical device, "no less." Please know that your place in the divine plan is no less important, no less great, and no less necessary than that of man. The effect on the listener of this repeated "no less" is particularly ambiguous. While the literal meaning of the phrase is meant to suggest equality, the effect of this construction is to emphasize the less. "I am telling you that you are equal," says President Hinckley, "but of course you know everyone thinks you are less." This brings up another interesting point about language which a feminist would pay attention to in a discourse like this one. As I mentioned earlier, we tend to perceive objects, concepts, etc., in opposition to other objects, concepts. We recognize a chair partly because it is not a table, a desk, a couch, or a piano. Thus, when we say chair, we simultaneously call up in the mind images of chair and not chair. This has interesting applications for President Hinckley's talk. For example, when he says, "A few Latter-day Saint women are asking why they are not entitled to hold the priesthood. To that I can say only that the Lord, through revelation, could alter that situation. He has not done so, so it is profitless for us to speculate and worry about it." The "not" said in this passage is that the Lord could and might alter the situation. Though it is profitless to speculate about it, President Hinckley's language actually invites us to do so. Similarly, When he lists the executive opportunities of the auxiliary presidents, he simultaneously calls up for the listener, largely subconsciously, the list of areas where they do not have executive power. When he climaxes that list by saying that Sister Young serves on the National Cub Scout Committee, the not said is the hundreds of other committees, almost all more powerful than the Cub Scouts, on which she might serve. Let me hasten to add, however, that I, for one, do not doubt President Hinckley's sincerity when he says, "My dearest sisters, you as women have tremendous executive responsibilities in the church, and no one appreciates more than I the wonderful contributions that you make and the great wisdom you bring." I think the not said here is the great personal burden this man has felt in his role as leader and chief executive of the church, and perhaps his personal friendship with and gratitude for the three women he is talking about. Here it is the not said which conveys his real emotions through the formal words of the official discourse. Another part of that official patriarchal discourse is the use of standard phrases and stereotypes about women and their roles. The most obvious of these are things like, "You possess an instinctive inclination to help those in distress and have a peculiar and remarkable way of doing so." This is very reminiscent of the angel in the house. "And we regard a happy marriage as the greatest mission any young woman can enjoy." When President Hinckley holds out rewards and promises to women, they tend to be peace, love, and security, stereotypically feminine desires, which I contrast to another talk in the same issue about spiritual adventures, which are held out to the men. But in this talk, in President Hinckley's talk, however, these kinds of stereotypes are used with a peculiar rhythm, which I call the give-and-take-away pattern. For example, President Hinckley spends three quite provocative paragraphs discussing scriptural precedents for women prophesying. But then he follows that up with a, "Can anyone doubt that many women have a special intuitive sense, even a prescient understanding of things to come?" Which seems to turn the spiritual power of prophecy back into stereotypical women's intuition. Similarly, he speaks of the great power of sister missionaries and follows up with the line about marriage being a woman's greatest mission. He celebrates at some length women's opportunities for education and then tacks on the old "in case you don't marry" and the familiar sense of security having an education brings to women. Where he began with women studying for science, the professions, and every other facet of human knowledge, he ends by urging women to enhance their appreciation of the arts, especially music. So we're back to the drawing room. Susan has already discussed italicization and the ways in which the hidden story is inscribed in a text. Recent feminist critics have paid a great deal of attention to points of rupture in women's texts, the places where the text transgresses the laws it seems to have set up for itself. Although it may not be obvious to a casual listener, there is also such a point in President Hinckley's women's meeting talk, a point at which the terms of opposition are reversed and man's fear of woman is revealed, the fear that lies behind all patriarchal discourse. The blessing that no man can enjoy is, of course, bearing children. As President Hinckley points out, without mothers, the race would soon die and the purposes of God would be totally frustrated. Thus, even God, in a sense, is dependent on women to fulfill his purposes, although President Hinckley is careful to assert from the beginning that motherhood is a God-given privilege. The glories of motherhood are, of course, another standard cliche, especially in Mormondom. What reveals the fear, however, the fear of the power women have, which men must keep under control, are his remarks about artificial insemination. "I recognize," says President Hinckley, "that there are many unmarried women who long to have a child. Some think of bringing this about by artificial impregnation. This the church strongly discourages. Those who do so may expect to be disciplined by the church. A child so conceived and born cannot be sealed to one parent. This procedure frustrates the eternal family plan." What is so insidious, so dangerous about artificial impregnation for single women? Simply that it leaves men out of the birth process entirely. It does indeed frustrate the eternal family plan, where a priesthood holder rules over the woman like God in exchange for the privilege of being mother. This one little paragraph taps into the fears of man since the beginning. As Dorothy Dinnerstein puts it, "Man's powerful impulse to affirm and tighten by cultural inventions their unsatisfactorily loose mammalian connection with children." Could the brethren of the church share in a guarded, veiled, and hidden way, hidden especially from themselves, the male ideology of a Norman Mailer who writes about another male writer? for he captured something in the sexuality of man as it had never been seen before, precisely that it was men's sense of awe before woman, his dread of her position one step closer to eternity, for in that step were her powers, which made men detest women, revile them, humiliate them, defecate symbolically on them, do everything to reduce them so one might dare to enter them and take pleasure of them. Man looked to destroy every quality in a woman which will give her the powers of a male, for she is already armed with the power that she brought them forth, and that is a power beyond measure. The earliest etchings of memory go back to that woman between whose legs they were conceived, nurtured, and near strangled in the hours of birth. Now, such language seems strong, even shocking, especially applied to the general blandness of a conference talk. I don't actually mean to suggest that President Hinckley and his spiritual colleagues are covering the kind of sexist animosity of Norman Mailer. But the conventions and traditions they have inherited for thinking about classifying and relating to women are built, feminists claim, on a foundation of fear and a need to control the root of that fear, women. In the midst of this otherwise progressive and loving talk, a hint of that collective fear emerges. Nonetheless, I find President Hinckley's talk a hopeful one. His careful calming of the standard works for scriptures which hold out promise to women, his emphasis on the powers and capabilities of women, his oblique inferences that radical changes are at least possible, and his personal expressions of gratitude and appreciation for women's contributions mark important departures from similar communications of only a few years ago. Unfortunately, as I hope I have demonstrated, the form in which these insights have been expressed tends to undermine their force. Besides the graphic presentation of the printed talk, the tone of authority established through the strong syntax, the insistent setting up of binary oppositions with one term, the male one, being privileged, the insistent use of you to emphasize women's otherness, the implications called up by the not said when discussing women's opportunities, the use of stereotypes in a give-and-take-away pattern, and the talk's navel, the rupture that lets in a vision of man's desperate need to control women. All these aspects of the discourse tend to subtly counteract the positive message the talk is trying to get across. President Hinckley discusses women's access to spiritual power in a power discourse that reinforces his own power and their exclusion from it. Still, it is a beginning. But for women to have full access to such power in the church, perhaps they will need to invent a new kind of Mormon discourse, one that will allow discussion and celebration of their capabilities and concerns without reinforcing their lack of any real power. I think it is in response to that need for another discourse that women have always joined together in discussion groups, neighborhood chats, Relief Society testimony meetings, and in their own publications, which the official church, incidentally, has consistently attempted to abolish. So perhaps, after all, the retreat is an approach for the Mormon feminist. But real progress will have been made only when the men in positions of power are also able to escape the confines of their patriarchal discourse and the modes of thinking about women which it forces on all of us.